the region has been hit very hard, and the economic effects were really devastating.
In this program, the economic prospects for sub-Saharan Africa in the latest outlook.
And what we have seen is that in just a few months, this crisis has essentially jeopardized years of hard-won development gains. Papa Njai, the head of the Regional Studies Division in the African Department of the International Monetary Fund.
And welcome to this IMF podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. The global pandemic has put intense pressure on economies across sub-Saharan Africa. Many governments are struggling to maintain macroeconomic stability while also meeting the basic needs of their populations. Papa Njai heads the IMF's economic outlook for the region. He says sub-Saharan Africa's economy will see its worst contraction on record this year, bringing real per capita incomes down to 2013 levels. So it looks like infection rates are actually considerably lower than in other parts of the world, but it certainly has disrupted, this pandemic has certainly disrupted lives and economies across the region. How has it played out since we last spoke in April?
On the health side, the infection rates in the region have been relatively low compared with other countries in the world. But we should be a bit cautious about these numbers because they could reflect the limited testing capability of countries in the region. So our view is that there's just no scope for complacency. We should be, we don't know how the pandemic will evolve going forward. We've seen in advanced economies repeated outbreaks, which suggests that it could remain a real concern for some time to come.
And so how has that played out economically?
On the economic front, this crisis has been devastating. In just a few months, the crisis has jeopardized years of hard-won development gains and upended the lives and livelihoods of millions of people in the region. Countries now are reopening their economies and looking for policies to restart growth. There is, in the high-frequency data, some indication that the worst has passed in terms on the economic front and that the situation is improving and will continue to improve in the second half of the year. So overall, we expect growth in 2020 to contract by 3%. And this is not very different from what we had back in June, in the June regional economic update. In 2021, we expect growth to recover to 3.1%. But this recovery is expected to be prolonged and uneven. The entire region is not expected to return to 2019 level of output until 2022. And for some of the region's largest economy, real GDP won't go or come back to pre-crisis level until, 2023 or 2024. So just to give you a sense of what this means in per capita term, we are talking about cumulative output losses in 2020 and 2021 of about 4.5%, which is larger than in any other region.
Wow. And so what are the worst hit sectors?
Tourism-dependent sectors that rely a lot on human interactions have been hit hard, the restaurants, hotels, and we've seen consequently, the largest impact of the crisis on tourism-dependent economies. Other commodity-dependent countries like oil and other commodities have also been hit hard. But no countries in the region will be spared. Even the more diversified countries will see a significant decline in growth because of this crisis. Mm.
Yeah, and the impact indeed runs very deep into the economies throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And the outlook suggests that it may literally turn the clock back decades on some of the aspects of development, like poverty reduction and life expectancy. Yeah. Yeah. What will it take to put things back on track?
Limited resources for policymakers in countries in the region means that they will face really very difficult choices. both fiscal and monetary policy will have to balance the need to boost the economy against the need for debt sustainability and external stability. Financial regulation and supervision will have to help the banks that are affected by the crisis without compromising the financial stability of the country and the financial system's ability to support long-term growth. So, and all these efforts will need to be balanced against the need to maintain social support while preparing the ground for sustained and inclusive growth over the long term. So, but navigating really this this complex environment will require significant help from the external community, from the international community, and from the private sector.
As in help in financing terms.
In financing, that's right. You know, the region is likely to face financing gaps of about $290 billion for between 2020 and 2023. And so without assistance, you know, most countries will struggle to maintain macro stability while meeting the basic needs of their people. And this is why, you know, the fund has acted swiftly during this crisis. Just in just a few months, it disbursed about $16 billion, or 12 times what it typically disbursed in the region before the crisis. And it also provided significant assistance to the poorest members through its catastrophe containment and relief trust fund. On top of it, you have the G20 that has come forward with some relief, providing some debt service relief through the DSSI. So it will be critical for the region to benefit from some external support to be able to navigate through these difficult challenges. This support, as I said, could come either as access to more grant, concessional credit, debt relief, and the participation of the private sector.
And the private sector has a pretty important role to play in the eventual recovery of the economies. So it's not only about governments and the international community, but it's about supporting private industry as well.
That's right.
And so given the extreme pressures on public finances, will countries be able to afford to buy the vaccine whenever it becomes available?
Mm-hmm. It's an important point. I mean, a key aspect really in combating the health crisis is to make sure that all the innovation, whether that's in testing, treatments, or vaccines, are produced at a scale that's enough to benefit all countries. And in this regard, you know, things like advanced purchase commitments for vaccines that are under trial could help spur this process for manufacturers, especially those who are hesitating to take the upfront cost. But it will be also important, some multilateral cooperation will be important here to provide help to all countries, especially low-income countries and countries in sub-Saharan Africa, to help them distribute doses and get vaccine doses and get the vaccines at affordable prices. It's not just also the vaccines, but all the know-how, the logistics as well that go with it.
Mm. Just make sure that the region is not left out of that important process.
That's right.
So with the billions in financial support that we've seen flowing into government coffers so quickly, how do you make sure this money is going to the right places?
So, of course, you know, we will continue to ensure that the fund resources that are made available to the members are safeguarded through our normal safeguard assessment. And, you know, in our multi-year financing arrangement, we continue to ensure that governance and anti-corruption measures, whether they are through prior actions or structural benchmarks, are included as needed in the design of new program, and that whatever commitment existed before that, those commitments are met. When you look at our rapid financing instruments, those are provided in the form of, you know, outright disbursement, and so there is much less scope for traditional, you know, conditionality conditions. However, in line with, you know, what we've done in past RFIs. In countries where there are significant vulnerabilities, the fund has been supporting countries, authorities in developing public financial management, anti-corruption, AML, CFT frameworks. Yeah. And these measures have been tailored to allow for the quick disbursement while ensuring that the assistance is used for the urgent purpose of resolving this current crisis and not diverted for other purposes. So the key really is to balance the efficient spending with appropriate control and accountability mechanisms. As our managing director has said, countries need to spend but keep the receipts. So,
Yeah, and also important that money is spent wisely and transparently so that they gain the confidence of the taxpayers who are actually going to help manage the debt coming out of this pandemic.
Absolutely. You know, both the help that's provided by the international community and the measures that will be taken by the countries themselves will involve, you know, getting support from taxpayers. Everywhere in the world, essentially.
And so debt is not a new issue. It was an issue before the pandemic and a significant issue before the pandemic, but has been growing also considerably. How much of a concern is the debt issue at this point?
You know, this crisis comes at a time when debt vulnerability in the regions were already elevated with about 17 countries in either in debt distress or at high risk of debt distress. And, you know, while the dynamics before the crisis were expected to either stabilize or come down, the crisis has changed a lot of that. Mm-hmm. Even though it's, you know, say it's very difficult at this stage to assess countries' debt sustainability, given the higher than usual uncertainty. One thing is clear, though, that most countries' debt carrying capacity has diminished because of a weaker outlook, growth outlook, because of lower reserves, because of lower commodity prices and remittances, for example. So it will be important for countries, once the crisis has waned, to put their debt position on a sustainable footing. For now, the priority remains saving lives and ensuring that the health systems are not overwhelmed. So countries need to create the space that is needed to make sure that the health systems are not overwhelmed and to provide the resources needed to save lives. Once this crisis has waned, mm-hmm. some countries will definitely be in that distress. And for those, it will be important to seek relief from their creditors. But all this, Bruce, to say that there will be a need for the international community. There will be a need for external support to help countries to navigate through this. Otherwise, if they don't get this additional support, they will be forced to undertake some significant adjustment that may be counterproductive even in terms of stabilizing debt. That ratios.
So yet another huge challenge that this pandemic is presenting. So we talked before the pandemic on several occasions during various regional economic outlooks about the potential demographic dividend for sub-Saharan Africa because of its young population. And while the pandemic has disrupted just about everything, it does seem that the region is faring better than others in terms of infection rates and deaths. And some say it is because of that younger population. Do you see any potential opportunities emerging from this crisis?
Absolutely. I think despite this crisis, the potential of the region and the resourcefulness of its people remains intact. And it's vital that the region taps this potential. This is the only way for it to find a way back towards sustainable and inclusive development. And I would say, you know, it's the only way for the region to be able to build a better future for its people, a greener one, more sustainable and inclusive, that can create all the jobs that are needed to absorb these new entrants into the labor markets and, you know, capitalize on its demographics. So achieving this would require transformative reforms, and these are reforms to promote resilience and lift potential growth, including through domestic revenue mobilization, promoting digitalization, further trade integration as part of the, say, the African continental free trade area, which in our view is a game changer for the region and could not only boost intra-regional trade, but also place the region higher up within global value chains, promote competition across firms, and put in place climate change mitigation policies, which, as you know, climate shocks, the region has been subject to a lot of climate shocks and would benefit from putting in place those climate change mitigation policies. All these measures will need to be supported by continued governance reforms, improved transparency, to build trust in the rule of law, and improve business conditions. And this will help countries capitalize on their demographics and catalyze the external support that they need to close these large financing gaps that the COVID-19 crisis has created.
Papanjai, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Papanjai heads the Regional Studies Division in the IMF's African Department. You can read the latest regional economic outlook for sub-Saharan Africa at imf.org. Look for more IMF podcasts wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe. You can also follow us on Twitter at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.